Today is Monday, April 9th. We'll work on the urinary system information today.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the urinary system, sometimes called the renal system, and that's going to be our focus pretty much this week. So on the very top of your page, you'll notice some functions of the urinary system. We probably all know before stepping foot in this classroom that this is the system that helps us get rid of metabolic waste from our bloodstream. Everything from breakdown waste products like urea, uric acid, ammonia, those kinds of things are removed in our urine. Notice the second thing listed there is to help us regulate the volume and composition of our blood. This is a great time for us to review. Can you tell me two hormones that help to increase blood volume?
Not cortisol.
It has no impact. ADH, aldosterone, good. Okay, so those old hormones back from the early chapters, those are the ones that help to maintain blood volume, blood composition. We're going to find also in this chapter that aldosterone does more than just maintain sodium and potassium levels in the body. It also plays a role in helping us maintain blood pH. So it's going to come back into conversation once again. And the kidneys are another set of organs that help us maintain acid-base balance. Now, this is not the only system to help us maintain acid-base balance. What other system does this? Respiratory, good. So we've got respiratory, and now we're going to talk about the urinary's role in acid-base balance. Let's see, we've also got number four. There helps us regulate blood pressure. All right, so a lot of things to think about here. What does ADH do to blood pressure?
Increases it
by telling your kidneys to retain more
water.
Good. What does aldosterone do to blood pressure? By making your kidneys keep more sodium. Yeah. Let's see, how about ANP? What does it do to blood pressure?
Decreases
it by making you get rid of more, that's it, and sodium and water. Yeah, good. We're also going to talk about things like EPO. What does EPO do to blood pressure?
Increases
it, yeah, because it makes your body make more
red blood cells.
Yeah, so we're going to kind of take all these things into consideration in this chapter. Okay, so number five there, we also make EPO in the kidneys. The stimulus for that is a low oxygen level in the bloodstream. And so EPO then travels from the kidneys, it targets our bone marrow, and in turn our bone marrow makes more red blood cells.
Low oxygen,
yeah, that's our stimulus. This is a pretty simple system. We're looking at two kidneys. We're looking also at two connecting tubes called ureters. They travel from each kidney to the urinary bladder. The urinary bladder is a storage tank, and then the exit pathway is called the urethra. Pretty simple, right? Just four primary organs for this system. Let's talk about the kidneys. The kidneys are about the size of a bath bar of soap. They're around 4 to 5 inches in length, and they're situated along the back part of your body wall. There's no muscle there that holds them in place. It's just some fascia, connective tissue, and fat pockets that help to hang them along the back part of your body wall. So it's like taking some tape and taping these soap bars to the back of your body and saying, hey, stay there for like 80 years, don't move, right? Because if they start to slide down the back part of your body wall, what happens to the ureters? They're like drinking straws. They kink and bend. And if they bend, what happens to the urine flow?
It's going to be constricted.
It's going to be constricted, yes. So anything that jars those kidneys from the back part of your body up underneath the lower ribs can actually make them slide or prolapse down the back part of your body wall. You'll notice the right kidney sits a little bit lower than your left kidney. There's an organ that's kind of forcing that right kidney down. That organ is
the heart.
The adrenal gland.
Yeah.
What organ pushes your right kidney down?
The duct.
What big digestive organ sitting over here?
Liver.
Yeah. So the right kidney sits a little lower thanks to the liver forcing it out of the way. Left kidney actually sits there a little bit higher. You are right. There are adrenal glands on the top of each of these. And there's a medial indentation right here where the vessels come and go, as well as some nerves and lymphatic vessels. That medial indentation is known as what? Hilus. That medial indentation is called a hilus. Okay. So let's talk about the three layers or regions of the kidney. Let's start from the outside and work our way in. We have an outermost cortex. We have a middle region called the medulla or medulla. And we have an innermost region called the pelvis. So you'll notice that for each of these terms, they put the word renal in front so we don't confuse it with some other body part. There is a cerebral cortex. There's also a renal cortex here. All right, so if you were to peel the kidney like an apple, this outermost piece that you would take off that's kind of brown in this picture, that'd actually be the capsule, okay? So if we come in from the capsule, this region right through here is what we consider to be the renal cortex. That renal cortex also makes these columns. These columns are situated between each of our renal pyramids. So that's also considered renal cortex or cortical tissue. All right, so if I'm looking for the renal medulla, I should look for what shape? If I'm looking for the renal medulla, I'm looking for the pyramids, okay? So the renal pyramids are in that medulla region, and you'll notice that all those pyramids are pointing toward the hilus region of your kidney. So let me repeat here. These pieces of tissue between the renal pyramids, they are not part of the medulla. They are, in fact, part of the cortex region.
What are they called again?
The pyramids?
In between.
Columns, or in between the pyramids.
Just columns?
Yeah, they're called renal columns. So let's repeat. So far, we've covered two types of regions in the kidney. We've got a cortex. This outermost piece right around here is called the renal cortex. Also included in the renal cortex are these columns. These columns are situated between these renal pyramids. Okay, so these columns are not medulla tissue, they're actually cortical tissue. Now the next type of tissue is called medulla or medulla tissue, and the renal pyramids belong to that region or layer. Okay, so these renal pyramids are found in the renal medulla. And the third and final region is called the renal pelvis. If you come into this basin-like area right through here, this is where the renal pelvis is located. It's the waiting room for pee. Okay, so when your kidneys make urine, the urine drips from the tips of these renal pyramids into minor calyces. Those majors join to form majors. Sorry, minors form majors. Those majors then join to form these renal pelvis basins like you see here. And then of course, once the urine starts to travel, it goes down the ureter and then to the urinary bladder for a holding tank. Okay, so far so good. Any questions here? Not too much, because they're not designed to stretch and hold urine. They're basically designed to generate it, and then it has to keep moving. So if you've got fluid that backs up here, you have like hydronephrosis, it can cause inflammation and be a big problem for your kidneys. Yeah. Let's see, in this picture, well, probably the previous one, we can see them better. Let's reemphasize, there's minor calyces, there's major calyces, and then there's the pelvis. Okay, so right around the tips of these renal pyramids are little grooves. Those are called our minor calyces. Okay, so little grooves right around the renal pyramid tips. If you follow, those grooves away from the kidney, away from those pyramid tips, you'll notice that a couple of those join, and those make what we call a major calyx. And the major calyces actually join to form this larger basin-like area. That's the renal pelvis. Okay, so the pathway of urine, it flows from the tips of the renal pyramids to minor calyces, to majors, to the renal pelvis.
To the minor league and the major.
Basically, yeah. Minor leagues to major leagues. Okay. If you got a highlighter handy, here is a part of a tracing. We're going to pick it up as we move through this stuff. Very bottom of the page. Whatever is destined to become urine will travel that pathway, very bottom there, from a renal pyramid's renal papilla to a minor calyx, major calyx, renal pelvis, ureter, urinary bladder, urethra. That is the exit route for urine. So we'll tie that in with another tracing in just a bit. Any questions so far? Okay, so let's flip on over to page 104. We're going to now turn our attention to a very tiny structure inside the kidney. It's called a nephron. And each of your kidneys contains about a million of these nephrons. In people who only have one functional kidney, their kidney actually can add nephrons and enlarge the size of the kidney to be able to handle the volume of blood in your entire body. So it's gracious to have two that can perform the job, but we can live with one functional kidney. On this model, you'll notice these little white squiggly lines. Those are representing the nephrons. So imagine a million of those nephrons sitting in each of your kidneys. Over a lifetime, those nephrons become less functional. So with every decade of life, we tend to lose functional efficiency in our kidneys. So, you know, if a person lives 100 years, then their kidneys are just barely working, right? But that's all it takes is just enough working to get rid of the waste products out of the bloodstream. So we're going to zoom in on that nephron and look at this picture. I've got a tiny one there in your course pack for you on 104, or you can flip over with me to the big one. It's on 111. So keep in mind, these are nephrons. These are the structural and functional units of your kidney. And we're going to label the parts of these, starting off with the two main portions. You'll notice on your sheet there's one called a renal corpuscle and a number two called the renal tubule. Okay, so let's talk about the renal corpuscle first. I'm going to circle this structure here, and this renal corpuscle includes two parts. Okay, so what should we call the capillaries inside that corpuscle?
Corpuscle capillaries, no, I'm just kidding.
That works right. I mean, you have to say the hard word, right? Yeah, it's close enough.
Another one of those fancy names.
It is a fancy name. So they're called the glomerulus or the glomerular capillaries. Yeah, I'm going to color them for you. Okay, so those glomerular capillaries, those are inside what looks to be a little capsule.
So the outer portion would be basically the Bowman's capsule.
That's right. Welcome to call it Bowman's capsule. You can call it glomerular capsule.
Which one are you going
to call them? I put both on there.
Oh.
Yeah. They're trying to get away from calling them by people's names, but
oh.
I'll probably use it, you know, with one in parentheses on there. So far we've covered the renal corpuscle. This is one of the two major parts of your kidney's nephron. That corpuscle includes a set of capillaries. You can call it the glomerulus or you can call it the glomerular capillaries. The second portion is a capsule. That capsule is called the Bowman's capsule or the glomerular capsule. Your choice of how they want to learn those two words. Questions so far? So the rest of this thing is called the renal tubule, and I want to talk to you about how this thing is named. You'll notice that as soon as we leave this capsule, we start down a twisty, winding tube, and we call that portion the PCT. P stands for proximal, of course C is convoluted and T is tubule. You can abbreviate it for short if you like. Travel through the PCT, then we're going to drop down and travel through a hairpin curve. As you head down this hairpin curve, you're going down the descending limb of that loop, and you can call it the nephron loop or you can call it the loop of Henle.
On the test, you'll have this like a parenthesis, you like one name in parentheses.
What I normally do is this, I'll put nephron loop. And I'll put of Henle, and that way you'll have the whole thing. Yeah. All right, so we're gonna head back up the other side. Start it like right there and take it till about right there. Okay, so looks like we're now heading farther away from the glomerulus. So the name of the next twisty curvy tube is called what?
DCT.
Good. Guys learned proximal and distal. You probably thought those words are history. They'll never come back to me again. And then here they pop up. The word proximal means close to, and it's close to your glomerulus and that Bowman's capsule. Okay, proximal is close to. And distal means where?
Further away from the point of attack.
yeah, farther away from the point of attachment. So yeah, if you go keep going along this tube, DCT is farther away from your glomerulus and capsule. So what you notice we finally end up with is a collecting duct or a collecting tube. I kind of think of it like a sewer line. You know, if you think about a sewer line that runs along a street, if people actually have sewage that goes into those sewer lines, everybody's house has a connecting pipe. You'll notice it's sticking off this collecting duct. There's those connecting pipes coming in. These are all DCTs that are dumping urine into this collecting tube. So this collecting tube travels down. We can call it collecting duct or collecting tube. Ultimately, it drips from the tip of a renal pyramid. Perspective, you know, we were talking about the renal pyramids earlier, and the tip of the renal pyramid is called a papilla. Urine drips from the tips of those renal papilla because all of these collecting ducts, I'm going to extend this down a bit, all of them point at the tips of those papilla. So you'll actually see, if you look on those models very closely in lab, little lines in each one of those renal pyramids, and those are the collecting ducts transporting urine to the tips. So, you know, big picture, that's kind of where we are. So in reality, if you were to take that piece of paper from page 111 and coil it up into a tube, you would find that your DCT actually gives a hug right up against your glomerulus. And this is how they exist in reality in your kidney. So they're not laid out flat like they are here on the board, but in reality, they're kind of in this more of a coiled up circular motion like we would see in a piece of paper rolled on itself. The reason I make this point is because when we talk about the DCT sitting snug up against your glomerulus, I don't want you to be confused. It is still farther from your glomerulus if you were to trace from one point to the other, you know, from beginning to end here. But in reality, there's kind of an interesting relationship the way those two pieces snug up against each other. How about questions so far on this picture? So far, so good. Anybody need a picture before I put the screen down? Going once. There is a multiple choice, and it will have letters like A through E, and I'll ask you, you know, what, tell me where the so-and-so is. Yeah.
Is this trace on the right here that recall the renal, the renal mechanism, or is this another one of the traces?
That is that renin angiotensin mechanism that we covered way back when. You'll need to know it. It may be an essay, but it will be embedded in the multiple choice. All right, anybody need this? Okay, so about middle of your page, I want you to look for a term that's $10,000 term, juxtaglomerular apparatus. Okay, and that's on page 104. You notice we call it JGA for short. It's called juxtaglomerular apparatus. Yeah. Okay, so tell me what you recognize about this picture. Do you find the glomerulus in this picture? All those twisted capillaries. And you said the surrounding piece is called?
The Bowman's capsule.
Good. And let's see, we've got a vessel coming in and a vessel leaving. The vessel coming in, you'll notice, is called an afferent arteriole. And what about the one leaving?
It's the proximal, it's the PCT.
Afferent, good. And then on the opposite side, if you get trapped by that capsule, your pathway is then to travel down that PCT, okay? So when you look really close here, you'll notice the DCT, as promised, is sitting snug up against the glomerulus, and right wedged between the glomerulus and the efferent, afferent, and DCT is a specialized set of cells. They're in a triangular region. They are what we call the JGA cells, okay? So juxtaglomerular apparatus, juxta meaning by or near. We're sitting nearby that glomerulus.
So the JGA, where did you say it was at?
This little triangular setup, these yellow cells right here, that's them. So they're wedged between afferent coming in, efferent going out, yeah. And right there is DCT. So it's all in that little wedge right there.
Couldn't really see the little ways that we're saying.
So the DCT, okay, I got it. DCT is the DCT.
That's right. Okay, okay with the picture? Got any questions on it? Need to go back through it again?
So the two arteries are just basically doing the same thing, they're just named differently?
Actually, they're really odd because normally arterioles feed capillaries and venules will drain the capillaries. But this is odd because you've got an arteriole feeding a capillary bed and not a venule draining it, but actually another arteriole draining that capillary bed.
So the afferent is going in and the efferent is going out?
Correct. And it's all about pressure, because if you don't have the high pressure there, you don't have the force to push out that plasma and filter it. So that's in fact why we have these JGA cells, is to detect blood pressure problems. So if you don't have enough push behind that blood, you can't filter out the bad stuff, those waste products that we would like to get rid of. And if you don't have enough force to push it out, where do those waste products go? Stay in the bloodstream, yeah. So you can end up being poisoned by that waste, yeah. So we've got to have enough force, enough hydrostatic pressure to push out those waste products, and that's why you have these JGA cells. It is their job to detect blood pressure problems, and specifically they're looking for low blood pressure issues, okay? So their stimulus is a low blood pressure problem. So as promised, we would come full circle. In the first week of this course, we probably talked about aldosterone, and I promised that we would come back and talk about it again, that you would eventually get the full story. So that is today. We do get the full story on aldosterone. All right, so if you have low blood pressure, you have a risk of not filtering out those waste products. Therefore, your JGA cells release a chemical called renin. Renin travels to the liver, okay? The liver releases angiotensin 1. We convert angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2 using an enzyme. That enzyme is called angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE. All right, so what do you know about angiotensin? What does it do to your vessels? Constricts. Good. It's a great vasoconstrictor, and by itself, what impact does angiotensin have on blood pressure?
It's going to make it increase.
Make it increase. Good. So that's, of course, part of the story. What we want to do is complete the story by telling the adrenals to release aldosterone. We also tell the posterior pituitary to release ADH, and together they are a tag team. What specifically does aldosterone tell your kidneys to keep? Sodium, and dump out your
potassium.
Potassium, yeah. And then ADH makes you keep.
Water.
There's your water, yeah. So together, that tag team of aldosterone and ADH makes you keep sodium and water. Both together act to increase blood pressure. Hey, you've come full circle. You now have a reason to shut off that stimulus, and the mechanism's no longer needed.
Right back where you started.
Yep. Anytime ADH and aldosterone are in control and they're causing you to retain more sodium and more water from the urine that's being created, how much urine output are you going to make? A lot or just a little?
Repeat.
Okay, so if ADH and aldosterone are in control of you and they're retaining fluids and sodium from the urine that's being created, do you expect to have a lot of urine made or just a little?
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. And it'd be what color?
It would be yellow, really,
really
concentrated.
Very concentrated, good, good. So we know that when we're dehydrated and we need to keep more fluids, that we're not gonna produce a bunch of urine. Okay, and that's what this mechanism does, you keep the fluids. Okay, so let's kind of talk about how this mechanism works. The kidneys act to maintain blood pressure. They are the regulating organs for blood pressure in the body. When blood pressure is too low, they turn on the release of what chemical?
Renin.
Renin, good. What does the liver contribute to maintenance of blood pressure?
Angiotensin.
Angiotensin 1 and 2. And to convert 1 to 2, you need what enzyme?
ACE.
ACE, good. And of course, you then let angiotensin 2 tag team your aldosterone and your ADH. Good. If you want to stop this mechanism, if you want to never make it down here to angiotensin 2 or aldosterone or ADH, you can shut off that angiotensin converting enzyme. You can shut that one down. So if you were to shut off this converting enzyme, you would not make angiotensin 2, you wouldn't make aldosterone, nor would you make ADH. What impact would we now have on blood pressure?
It would drop.
Yeah.
So ACE is one of those kind of enzymes that has to be present for it to be converted.
Yeah. And you may have heard of drugs called ACE inhibitors. People take those to help shut down ACE conversions from angiotensin 1 to 2. They take those to lower blood pressure. So you're exactly right. You'll end up peeing out more urine, and the risk you run is dehydration, but the thirst mechanism should make sure that you keep enough fluids in your body. But yeah, that's one of those blood pressure regulating mechanisms. Okay, this is guaranteed to be either multiple choice and or essay material. So we've been here quite often. I just want to make sure that you had an opportunity to jot this down if you need it. This feel pretty familiar? Okay, got any questions on it? Okay. Anybody else need a picture? Good to go. All right. So nephrons come in two different forms. I should mention to you, very bottom of the page, some of them are considered cortical and some are considered juxtamedullary. They kind of tell you where they're at. The cortical nephrons actually sit more toward the cortex, and the juxtamedullaries, well, as our name implies, sit across the medulla and run the length of that medulla. Just looking at them, can you tell a physical difference between the two? Do they look identical? Does the nephron loop have the same length on both of them?
No.
That's the difference, right? So which one of these nephrons has a shorter nephron loop? The cortical one. And of course, this juxtamedullary has a really long nephron loop. Here's the catch. The more time the filtrate spends in the nephron loop, the more time you have to reabsorb fluids back into your bloodstream. What that means is, if you send fluids down this long nephron loop, you're going to reabsorb most of the fluids back in the bloodstream, and what you end up making is very concentrated urine. So the juxtamedullary nephrons make concentrated, very dark yellow urine, and by contrast, what kind of urine do those cortical nephrons make?
Almost probably clear.
Very light clear, yep, so that makes a more dilute urine simply because you've got a short nephron loop and the filtrate can't spend as much time cycling through there.
So that's why your urine gets more concentrated, is because they stay in there longer?
Yeah, if you're dehydrated, then it will actually spend more time in that nephron loop right there. Any questions on this page? Let's see, on page 105, this is one of our tracings. In fact, this page, bullet point from the first one to the last one, is our first tracing down there at the bottom. It says, trace the pathway of a red blood cell from the renal artery back to the renal vein. That is it at the top of your page. Okay, so as it's written, those bold-based terms, those would be your tracing points. And we're gonna go over it right now, too. Five arteries that lead into your kidney, and there's four veins that lead out. Which vein is not found in that exit pathway that is found as an artery in the entrance pathway?
Segmental.
That's right. I should also mention to you that the kidneys, when we are forming as fetuses, develop about 3 or 4 times, and that's what gives rise to these various different pathways. If you pull an A&P textbook from the library, you're going to find a different flow pathway in pretty much any textbook you select. If you get into your programs and they give you a different pathway, it's just that maybe that particular textbook uses a different flow pattern. So because our kidneys form and are reabsorbed and reform and keep this up several times, there's a lot of disagreement over what is the actual correct pathway of blood through the kidney. So instead of reading that to you, let's look at a picture and we'll map it out this way. We're going to start with a blood flowing into the renal artery, and the renal artery splits into around 5 segmental arteries. Okay? These segmental arteries give rise to what?
Interlobar
arteries. You'll notice that they sneak between our renal pyramids. In fact, they're traveling around where those renal columns are located. All right, what is our next artery?
Arcuate,
good. Notice how they sit at the base of each of our renal pyramids, all the way around the entire kidney. These are all arcuate arteries that sit at the base of your renal pyramid. If you look at the nephron models in lab, those arcuate arteries always sit horizontal, and these cortical radiates that come across, they're always sitting coming off vertical. So that's just a good clue to use when you're looking at those nephron models in lab. These cortical radiate arteries around the perimeter are in fact in the renal cortex. There's an alternate name for them. You can also call them what?
Interlobular.
Good. Anything confusing here? You just had an interlobar, right? Okay. If you were learning these by interlobar and then interlobular, just keep in mind, the further you get away from the renal artery, the longer that word gets. Otherwise, you can end up flip-flopping those two. That's why I say probably look at that cortical radiate and call it that. That way you don't get confused as, ooh, is this the interlobar or am I on interlobular at this point? I would just eliminate that confusion from my brain. All right, let's hit it from the top. We come in through a renal artery. We split into segmental arteries. We have interlobars next, arcuates, good, and cortical radiates, good. So in a closer look, you can actually see these cortical radiates coming off of the arcuate arteries, and each one of them gives rise to one of those capillary beds. So let's zoom in. Once again, here is arcuate running across horizontally, and coming off vertical, this is that interlobular or cortical radiate artery. Let's take this afferent arteriole. It carries us toward the renal corpuscle, okay? So here we are, interlobular or cortical radiate artery. We're gonna take the afferent arteriole toward this glomerulus. Well, since we're talking about the pathway of a red blood cell, red blood cells are not filtered at the glomerulus. They're just going for a joyride through, and they keep on trucking in the vessel lineage. So from that glomerulus, how do we get back out? Afferent, good. Go to those afferent arterioles. Like I mentioned earlier, this is an oddball flow pattern. Normally, we learn that arterioles feed capillaries, and capillaries drain into what? Venules. But this is unusual. We've actually got an arteriole coming into a capillary network and an arteriole leading us away. All right, so if you take this efferent arteriole and follow it, it becomes a set of capillaries that wrap your nephron, and these are called what? Peritubular capillaries, okay? So notice the weirdness here. We have an afferent arteriole. It leads us into a set of capillaries. And then we've got an efferent arteriole that leads us to another set of capillaries. They're peritubular. And then finally, you hit a venule. There's not a name for the venule, but we're going to locate it right about there. And then we link up with our interlobular vein. What is the other name for interlobular vein?
Cortical radiate.
Cortical radiate, good. From there, we travel to this arcuate vein. Let's go back. Okay, it's the base of your pyramids. And then we travel to which vein on our way out?
Interlobar
vein. And there is no segmental, so our next stop is what vein?
Renal vein.
Renal vein, right. So keep in mind, no segmental or exit pathway coming back toward the renal veins. Want to hit it one more time? Okay. So from the beginning, we're going to start with a renal artery. It takes blood flow into the kidney. It branches off into segmental arteries, and then branches off into what? Interlobar. Good. We then are sitting at the bases of the pyramids in what type of artery? Arcuate, good. And they give rise to these little arteries out here at the perimeter called?
Cortical radiate.
Now they radiate around the cortex. So that makes good sense. All right, so here we are. We've got the arcuate artery here. We've got cortical radiate coming here. And we're gonna branch off on one of these afferent arterioles. We now travel to a set of capillaries. They're called what? Glomerulus. And then because we're not being filtered here, we travel back out by way of what vessel?
Efferent
arterioles. Good. Now we travel from that arteriole to this set of capillaries that wraps your nephron called peritubulars. Good. And those peritubular capillaries link us to a venule. And now we're back into the vein pathway. What vein are we dumped into? Cortical radiate, good. Cortical radiate veins take us to this vein here. Arcuate vein, we can go back and watch it sitting there at the base of the pyramids. Arcuate veins dump us into another vein called? Interlobar vein. No segmentals here, so here we go, exiting by the renal vein. Arcuates across the bottom, yeah. So five arteries in, four veins leave, okay? And then of course you gotta remember that arterioles feed a set of capillaries. That takes you to another arteriole, that takes you to another set of capillaries. So a little weirdness there in that flow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe it's us and our naming schemes, right? Okay, so that is number one at the very bottom of your page. That is your red blood cell tracing. So I'd like to introduce you just to a little bit into the three major jobs of your kidney, and this will take us over to page 106. So when we started this chapter, I mentioned to you that one of the jobs of your kidneys is to get rid of waste products. We want to put those waste products in our urine and get rid of them. Sometimes we actually end up filtering things that could be in our urine that we in fact want to keep. Things like glucose and amino acids and even water we want to keep. So it's your kidney's job to decide, hey, this is bad, we're going to get rid of it as a waste, versus this is something useful, let's actually keep this item. And mixed into all of this process is acid-base balance and fluid electrolyte balance. So there's a lot going on here that we're going to have to be mindful of. We're going to talk probably on Wednesday in a little more detail here about filtration and reabsorption. Filtration is a process that takes place in those glomerulus, okay? And those capillaries are built in order for us to filter blood. So I thought I'd just give you a little sneak preview of where we're heading Wednesday so you'll have some a little bit of background info coming up for Wednesday. Okay, so what feature should a capillary have if you would like to force fluids across the wall of the capillary? If you want your vessels to be leaky, what kind of features should they have?
Holes.
Yeah, poke them full of holes, right? You don't want them to be closed capillaries, you want them to be open and porous capillaries. So these things here that look like octopus are in fact specialized cells that create holes on your glomerular capillaries. They're called podocytes because of their many-footed nature. And they're actually there to help us push fluids out of your capillaries. But here's the catch. We don't want them to be so large, these holes here to be so large, that we lose big stuff like blood proteins and blood cells.
So you just want to let the vast stuff out to keep the big
stuff. That's exactly it. Let it be just big enough, all right? Okay, so if you have a mental image of a colander, if you strain spaghetti or pasta through a colander, the holes are just the right size to let the fluid through and not the solid pasta. So that's exactly what we're looking for. So we want to squeeze out your blood plasma, but we don't want to squeeze out big things like blood cells or blood proteins. Okay, so that means red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets should not be filtered. They should not be squeezed across the wall of your capillaries.
What did you say, red blood cells? Red blood cells, white blood cells, what?
Platelets. Any blood cells should not be filtered by your glomerulus. Okay, so no blood cells should be filtered. They're too big. Likewise, no blood proteins should be filtered. They are also too big to be forced out. So no blood proteins should be filtered. What that means is tiny stuff like electrolytes, water molecules, sodium ions, potassium ions, even some waste products are going to be small enough that they can be filtered out through that podocyte membrane that's found on the glomerular capillaries. So it is a size-regulating membrane. Only the tiny stuff gets to escape. The big stuff we're not going to let escape. If you happen to have an infection and you do end up losing some of those blood proteins or maybe those blood cells, you cannot get them back. So I think we all know that having blood in our urine, if you're female and not menstruating, you know, but blood in the urine should be a sign of something going wrong with the kidneys, most likely an infection. Likewise, we look at things like proteins lost in the urine and we say, this kind of points back to another problem. It could be inflammation, it could be something like a burn. So we know that blood proteins and blood cells are too big. They should not be lost through that podocyte, through that membrane of the glomerulus. Okay, so what are some things that are okay to filter? Electrolytes, water in the plasma. Good stuff like glucose, bad stuff like waste can be filtered here, but yeah, the big stuff is what we're not going to choose to filter. That should be under normal conditions. Okay. So why don't we come back to this page? We'll pick up here come Wednesday. We will likely work through the rest of this chapter, so if you want to preview where we're heading, we're going to work through all the rest of these pages.